Welcome to the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action by the Center for Humanitarian Action in Berlin. My name is Anne Tritschler and I'm the communications manager at CHAR. In this podcast episode, I pass the microphone to CHAR director Ralf Süthoff, who welcomes Michael Köhler, former DG ECHO and current Grand Bargain ambassador, to the chat room studio.
Lieber Michael Köhler, dear Michael, welcome to the chat room, the CHAR podcast on humanitarian affairs. It's a pleasure having you.
Thank you very much, Ralf. Pleasure is all mine.
Michael, how are you? You have only weeks ago retired from your leading position at ECHO, and now you sometimes reply to emails from a sailing boat. That sounds quite nice. How are you?
Well, actually, when I'm on a sailing boat, I really don't try to reply. But the fact that we are phoning each other right now shows that I'm rather in my office at home. I still continue to live in Brussels for some years. I'm actually quite active, but now with things that are pleasure. Think tank work, university teaching, writing papers, opinion pieces and so forth. And it feels quite good, I have to say. I don't regret too much the day-to-day treadmill that I was in before.
I can imagine that, and we all envy you, I'm sure about that. It sounds like a great life, and not a very retired one. Michael, as part of our podcast series on European humanitarian aid, we want to talk a bit about European humanitarian aid, look a bit back on the experiences you made, and look a bit ahead with European elections upcoming, and these coming with potentially some major challenges also on the humanitarian side. But for a start, in this podcast, we always like to ask guests to bring something and to share a moment which links them and their previous experiences with humanitarian aid. And in your case, of course, that's a very big question. You've been into the sector for more than 30 years. You've been engaged in development projects in Tunisia, in Morocco. You've been with the German Development Ministry, BMZ. And then moving on 30 years ago to the European Commission and finishing as the Director General of ECHO, the European Civil Protection and Humanitarian Aid Operations of the Commission, while you serve today even as a Grand Bargain Ambassador, as an ambassador for the probably most important reform project for humanitarian aid. So if you look at all that, is there anything single, any symbolic you could share, a moment or something you recall which you would like to share?
Well, on the one hand, there's of course a feeling of gratefulness because during my, 37 years of career, I was serving on 14 different posts in four countries. I've seen quite a lot. My humanitarian experience is actually relatively short. I only started in 2019. But as you rightly point out, I worked for many, many years in development. Actually, my very first two posts after leaving university were posts as project director in Morocco and Tunisia. So I've seen the ground myself. I've seen the reality of projects. I've done the annual reporting, the financial stuff and so forth. And I have looked at project international cooperation work from both sides. Now, the one thing that I really find was a marking experience is that it doesn't make any sense if we pursue our work, be it in the humanitarian area or in the development area or in other areas, if we pursue this work in silos, in pure silos. And, you know, asking me about an anecdote, I was thinking back to a mission that I performed to Yemen about 2 years ago. I was sitting down in an IDP camp called Ashab 1 in the area of Aden, discussing with the women in the camp, women only, actually. And, you know, I was asking them, what can we do to help you better? How can we be more accountable? What do you need? And so forth. And I was expecting that they would ask me, we would like to have better childcare. We would like to have better medical care. We would like to have a better food basket or whatever. But to my great surprise, they asked me for jobs for their husbands. That was an eye-opener. You know, I've seen similar stories, so to say, quite a lot over the years. What these ladies meant was that basically the system that they were benefiting from was already providing shelter, healthcare for the children and so forth. So the very basics were there. But their husbands were working as day workers in a very precarious environment. So there was no guarantee that they would bring home any money in the evening. But if they wouldn't bring home money in the evening, then the family didn't really have money to care for their immediate needs, for example, for buying better food. So it was a matter of dignity, but it was also a matter of basically standing on their own feet, providing the food that the family really wanted and not what donors were providing and implementing partners were providing. And that's what they wanted. And, you know, that reminded me of something I'd heard at one of the retreats of the humanitarian coordinators of the UN system together with their partners. And they were telling me on the occasion, when we ask our beneficiaries, to use the terminology, when we ask them a humanitarian question, you always get a development answer, not a humanitarian answer. So I think in our world today, if we want to really be accountable to the people that we want to work for and that we want to help, we need to look at their real needs. We don't need to look at what our silo allows us to mobilize. So nobody can survive, especially in a protracted crisis, only with humanitarian aid. You also have to look more comprehensively at food needs, at health needs, at education needs, at protection needs. For that, you need to mobilize development, you need to mobilize peace building, you need to mobilize governance aid, and so forth. And that is something where our system is extremely weak, because we all represent our financial instruments and our silos. We never represent the interests of the people we want to work for. And that has really marked me.
Many thanks. That was already a statement on your current mission as well, given that you now work as a Grand Bargain Ambassador, especially also on this linkage, on the nexus between humanitarian and development issues, which is very important to materialize, apparently, on the European level, as well as we know it, for example, from Germany. Talking about European humanitarian aid, Michael, few people know that the European Commission itself is the world's second or third largest donor in any given year. And even fewer people know that Europe in sum is the largest humanitarian donor, even ahead of the US. So that underlines its relevance. At the same time, European elections are upcoming, and there are major concerns that by a right-wing populist party move in key countries and in the European Parliament, humanitarian engagement might be under threat by Europe, its principles, its budgets. Do you share these concerns?
Well, on the one hand, Ralf, I think you have been very, very kind by giving us a rank in the statistics, so to say, that is probably mathematically right, but it requires a lot of generosity, because Europe would be number one only if you take all the European states together. So not only the European Commission and the EU member states, but also Norway and also the United Kingdom. And even then, we would not lead with a, let's say, very tremendous, very significant margin in comparison to the United States. In reality, I think Europe should do more, because together we are a bigger market in the European Union than the United States, but we also have more population in the United States. And obviously, you know that last year in May, the Council, the Foreign Ministers Council of the European Union, set some sort of voluntary targets, not only for development, but also for humanitarian aid, because actually we have quite a number of EU member states, to look only at them, who are not yet significant donors of humanitarian aid. Now, with respect to your political question, the elections between the 6th and the 9th of June, you know, you can look at the prognosed results with a laughing and with a crying eye. On the one hand, I mean, the latest polls, the latest predictions do not really indicate that you would have a full swing to the right, to the extreme right. Yes, the polls start by stating that, of course, in many member states of the European Union, the center-right and the extreme-right are going to win quite significantly. But when you add all these figures together, this would not mean that they would basically take the whole thing over. it would mean that probably you would need to find a way to associate them to any kind of legislative process in the European Parliament. But it might well be that the coalition or the kind of understanding between the European People's Party, the Socialist Party, the Liberal Party, and the Greens that we have seen over the past couple of years will still be able to harness a majority. But even if it was different, what I state, and, you know, if you look at, for example, what happened in the Trump years in the United States, what happened in Sweden and Finland after the elections there, you do not see that when right-wing governments come in, they would cut humanitarian aid. And I think that has two reasons. One reason is, on the one hand, that usually every government has to take into account the views of Parliament. For example, in the United States, when Trump wanted to cut, it was Congress that basically slowed him down. But then these governments always have a number of foreign affairs interests in the area of stabilization, in the areas of stemming irregular migration, where they have the feeling that ultimately if they cut humanitarian aid, they will basically shoot in their own feet. So what we have seen, for example, in Sweden, is that the center-right government there has been cutting development aid, but not humanitarian aid. Now, you know, therefore, I speak about a laughing eye and a crying eye. On the one hand, as a humanitarian, I could say, well, it's great if, you know, we are being spared by the cuts. On the other hand, I have a crying eye because, obviously, any euro, any dollar, any Swiss franc that is being saved in from the budget of development aid, basically, is also indirectly impacting on the humanitarian needs, because humanitarians will be asked to take over certain things that development funding has been financing so far, or the humanitarian caseload will increase because certain basic social services will no longer be financed. So it's not good news.
And in particular, in the context of the nexus you mentioned.
Exactly so. But it's not only the nexus in its pure form. It's basically also, you know, the scenario that we have in so many countries with a so-called estranged government, you know, a government that is not being recognized by the international community. If a government doesn't have the money any longer, for example, to pay for health workers, doctors, nurses, and so forth, and also for people in the health ministry, this means that then the humanitarian engagement in the health sector has to increase. We have to send more mobile teams. We have to bring in more drugs. We have to pay the health personnel that we recruit or that our local partners are recruiting. So the bill becomes more expensive for humanitarians when development is out. That goes a little bit beyond the classic nexus. And that's a tendency that we see, unfortunately, in many countries, because ODA flows to countries in a fragile situation for 2 or 3 years now are basically on the way south. There is something like a collective neglect of fragile country situations in the global south. That, in my view, is very bad news for the people there. It's very bad news for humanitarian aid. But it's also bad news in the midterm for the donor countries, because this creates more instability and more insecurity worldwide.
Maybe building a bit on this great potential you also touched on the European side. I mean, on the one hand, there is also very good news. The only countries reaching this target of 0.7 GNP for investing into development humanitarian, for reaching it or exceeding it, are all coming from Europe. The most famous or most well-known countries and donors increasing against the trend these days, their budgets on the humanitarian side are countries like France and Spain, etc. This puts Europe in a way in a poor position to move reform and to change humanitarian aid, while at the same time, many say, as you hinted on it, it's so fragmented and it's often poorly coordinated. Might that be a criticism which is fair and which is at the same time also feeding into this narrative of right-wing populists that it's all a waste of money and it's badly coordinated and why should we engage at all? And could Europe do much better on this front if it would better join forces?
Well, we have three different scenarios. If you take the big European countries, you have Germany that has become a major, the second or the third most important humanitarian aid donor, basically back since 2015. You have France that was not a major donor but has now advanced to number 10 in statistics. because the president, but also probably many other people in the administration who look at France's not only international position, but also security concerns, have found out that it would be a very good investment to increase humanitarian aid. And you have Italy, that is also a G7 member and actually also quite an active financing source for development aid, but not so for humanitarian aid. So there is no such thing as a common European approach when you look at the member states. And I think the first thing is to, to spread out a bit more widely and bring those countries on board that are not traditionally financing humanitarian aid. Secondly, also to keep those countries on board who have become a source for humanitarian aid, but mainly because of the crisis in Ukraine. But a country like Romania, a country like Poland, that have an important role in international government, should look beyond their immediate neighborhood. They also have interest in the Middle East, they have interest in Africa and so forth. And therefore, I think it would be justified much beyond the humanitarian community that they would also operate there. Now, we have to be honest. The increase of humanitarian funding by, for example, the European member states, by Germany, by the Netherlands and so forth, since 2015, let's take that as a starting date, was debt financed. It was debt financed. And therefore, you cannot simply discard the argument of those people who said we increased incredibly as a consequence to COVID, and then we increased again because of the Ukraine crisis. At some point, we have to pay back the debt. At some point, we have to basically be a little more reasonable when it comes to the way how we finance our expenditure. I think that's the debate that you have in Berlin right now. On the one hand, I think it would be absurd to go the full way and basically say we cannot underwrite debt any longer for things that are important investments. But on the other hand, of course, it is important that these countries, and that's an argument I've heard in Sweden and other countries as well, that these countries see that they are not being left alone, but that also other European countries basically come on board and say, this is a collective task. And actually, it's not a waste of money because, yes, we help individual people. We do this applying humanitarian principles. We are neutral. We are independent. But we also do this, of course, because we see it has a positive impact on our security. Why would otherwise the European Union spend so much money, for example, in Syria? How could we explain that donors, by and large, not only the Europeans, and I regret it actually, are spending so much more money in geographically close countries rather than, for example, in Sudan or in Chad. I think first need to come to a larger common understanding. When you say there's a very strong European footprint in humanitarian aid, I think that is true. But if you look at the geography, in reality, it is very largely a northwestern European footprint. I would like to enlarge this by a southern European footprint, by an eastern European footprint. We have these very encouraging signs from Spain, where Spain wants to increase its financial profile until 2030, and not only as a matter of declaration, but they passed this law in February last year. That is excellent. But we need to see similar development elsewhere. And then, of course, yes, it is right. We have to, on the one hand, reach out to others in the world, to basically tell them we want to open our wallets, but please do the same. And secondly, we need to check whether with the money that we mobilize, we are on the right track. And as I said earlier, I think we have an increasingly visible problem that we are operating in fragile country situations, but we are operating in a way that basically only helps people to survive from one day to the next, which is, of course, very important. But we do not operate in a more holistic, in a more integrated way that helps us at least to seize those opportunities that there may be in order to either diffuse the crisis or participate in solving the crisis. And that is something which I see as a major challenge for the coming years.
Many thanks, Michael, for highlighting this issue of burden sharing and the great diversity even within Europe. I think like the five leading donors from Europe provide 85% of the overall humanitarian budget coming from Europe, and that gives you an indication how big the diversity is. Having said that, coming back to the issue of coordinating among the leading donors for a start, of course, it's a key challenge to coordinate even only EU member states and to make them jointly move for a more local humanitarian aid, for a more transparent one, for a more transparent financial way forward, which crises are funded by whom. Having said that, we published a paper lately on this European coordination issue, and a couple of interviewees have been very bluntly. One former government representative said, in fact, donor coordination meetings are mostly chaotic and pointless. An ECHO representative said the coordination potential is tremendously underused on the EU level. And a key question from our view would be, if Europe is the one, and European actors are for a start, these leading ones, are the ones who are in the driver's seat for changing aid and making it more effective and prioritizing it these days, because you highlighted the financial challenges. How could that better been achieved? Because another part of our analysis has been there is sometimes very good coordination in some areas, especially in ad hoc emergencies, when in Afghanistan with the Taliban taking over or when Ukraine war started. But on the more strategic issues, on the long-term reforms, but also on the political issues like the Gaza crisis, coordination is very poor, many interviewees said. Would you agree with that point of view? Is that an issue and how could it be overcome?
Well, in all areas of international cooperation that I know, coordination leaves to be desired. You could have a similar discussion in development aid, for example, or also when it comes to foreign policy proper. This has to do with the fact that in your toolbox for coordination, you only have carrots, you don't have sticks. Ministers who meet, basically every month in Brussels, or at least every other month when we speak about development ministers, they can decide a lot. They can agree on many things. But then if one member state disagrees or agrees on paper but then doesn't follow suit in their practical implementation of aid, you have no other possibilities than perhaps to name and shame. You cannot go to court. You cannot isolate the country or so. And that is a tricky thing. And let's be honest. I mean, in humanitarian aid, you have two kinds of people. You have those people who are humanitarians and want to do humanitarian work. And you have other people that are basically ensuring that humanitarian aid gets the resources. These other people, they sit in the prime minister's offices, they sit in parliament, they sit in budget committees, they sit in ministries of finance. They may have a big heart for humanitarian aid, but when they allocate money to humanitarian aid, which is always money that they then cannot allocate to other sectors, they usually want to pursue a political objective. And, I have not yet come across a situation where, for example, a country says, please, let's use our humanitarian aid in crisis X, Y, or Z because we have political interest there. And then the humanitarians of the same country would say, good idea, but unfortunately we cannot do this because we agreed with our partners in Brussels to do something totally different. I think, one has to be politically realistic. The resource allocation often follows other criteria than only humanitarian criteria. So the question is, if you don't have sticks, can you make the carrots more juicy, more attractive? And that is, of course, difficult. I would agree with your assessment that often humanitarian aid coordination works quite well in case of an urgency, simply because people from all the agencies, from all the donors then feel the heat. They really feel that now we need to stick together. If we don't do this, then probably we will be divided against each other. People may play us out one against the other. So we have seen this in Afghanistan, we have seen it in Yemen, so forth, and on a couple of occasions it has worked extremely well. And in order to harvest that fruit, it just needs somebody that basically brings all the decisive players together. It's one of the reasons why during my tenure at ECHO, we have We have tried to bring together on most of the international crises very regularly senior officials from all around the donor community and the implementing community. And we have been very open in that regard, bringing on board not only those who are the most engaged, but also those that we would like to engage, countries like Saudi Arabia, countries like South Korea, and so forth, that we wanted to take an interest in the crisis. That is true for the Sahel, that is true for Yemen, it's true for Afghanistan, for Syria, obviously, and so forth. But maybe there are other possibilities. If you look at the experience of development aid, what I see is that in the so-called global gateway approach, our development colleagues are now relatively successful with so-called Team Europe projects or Team Europe initiatives. That's basically a technique whereby, the European Commission, some development banks, like, for example, the European Investment Bank, but also some member states say, well, this is a project that we find interesting. We want to fund it together. We pool our money and do it together. I have not seen very much of the like in the humanitarian sector, but we could think of it. If, for example, we see the situation in Sudan, the biggest internal displacement crisis in the world, destabilizing an entire region, if we are concerned about that, if we see that this crisis is only up to 5% funded, or the humanitarian needs are only 5% funded, why not perhaps try to find out two or three like-minded countries, not necessarily European, but they can be European, of course, and say, okay, if there's a major food problem, for example, let us set up a joint response to this with European money, but perhaps also with German money, also with Australian money, also with Canadian money, and so forth. And let's find out whether we can find a common governance structure in order to guide the action under this program. This has not yet been tried. It might be worth to try it. I think the technique, if you want to have more effective coordination, has to be to find carrots that basically everybody finds very delicious to bite into. You need to have something that gives every donor and every implementing partner that takes part in this initiative the idea that, something is in for them. And I think there's still some room for improvement.
And how do you see the challenges coming with it? Of course, you made this comparison between development. Some also compare it to security issues, peace building, and to share a narrative and or a political linkage which links to national interest, to security interest, and by that tries to ensure or even raise, for example, humanitarian funding. The con perspective is, very often, if we start to build on that, if we contribute to this narrative, what about all the crises where these linkages are not obvious or where it's even impossible because it's only needs-based, and that's the humanitarian principle. Would you see a concern? You mentioned the Global Gateway Initiative. Some see it as a great opportunity because billions are on the table. Others say, if we link us to this, which not maybe everybody knows, this European initiative linking geopolitical interest, raw material outreach, global alliances to the global south with development issues, if we link it to humanitarian affairs as well, who will ever fund the forgotten crisis, which is, for example, also a key priority for ECHO, has been for many years. Is this a concern you share from your European experience, or do you think it doesn't matter, you just have to be pragmatic?
Well, I think this concern has to be taken very seriously, but then also not being blown out of proportion. I mean, in almost every country that I know, in every donor nation that I know, humanitarian aid is being managed by the foreign ministry. It is being considered as an instrument of foreign policy, but then this as such does not mean that that humanitarian aid is being compromised. In the European Union, for example, we have a legal basis for humanitarian aid. This is Article 214 in the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union. This article is actually an article in the Foreign Affairs chapter of the treaty. So looking at it from a legal point of view, also for the European Union, humanitarian aid is part of foreign policy. But then if you look at the content of this article, it basically obliges us, and this is primary law, this has almost constitutional rank, it obliges us to implement humanitarian aid according to the humanitarian principles, including neutrality, independence, non-discrimination, and humanity. So, the fact that we consider humanitarian aid as part of foreign policy doesn't mean that we abuse of it as a short-term tool for kind of murky foreign policy interests. Actually, I can honestly tell you that in my 5 years in the senior management of ECHO, I have not come across a single situation where I would have felt that humanitarian aid is being abused for foreign policy interests in the short term. I have always felt that our foreign affairs and also our military colleagues have very high respect for the humanitarian principles and understand why we want to remain principled. However, it is true, obviously, that much of the additional money that over the past 10 years has gone in the humanitarian sector anywhere in the world was mobilized because the people who are deciding on the money, and these are, for example, parliaments, budget committees, and so forth, because they were not just, you know, philanthropic, but also because they saw very serious security concerns that they thought have to be tackled, including through humanitarian aid. It's a fact of life. I don't see any country in the world where this would be different. So the question is not so much why do people give us the money? The question is how do we implement it? And then you can, and that is what we have done in the European Union, you can impose on yourself some sort of self-discipline. This is why ECHO has taken this commitment many years ago that at least 15% of the ECHO budget should be used for forgotten crisis. And actually, I'm very happy that in reality, we every year we exceed this figure. We are basically in the 22-25% range financing forgotten crisis. The question is really about the how and not so much the what. And until, proof of further disasters, I would think that the present system works relatively well.
Interesting point. If it's a fair summary, you argue for accepting that there is a political element and you need to build on this momentum for ensuring funds, for increasing them in crisis, for the Ukraine, which of course is in some ways over proportionally funded compared to some crisis not having that media attention, but at the same time to ensure a baseline on the crisis, which are not that much politically relevant or in the media, and to ensure a baseline of core funding going to them, which is, again, matching what, for example, we proposed in our paper. Michael, on another point, asking how this lack of reform and this threat to future funding might also be safeguarded on the humanitarian side to ensure that neither threats might become reality. Might the potential financial challenges, the tremendously underfunded humanitarian system, which by now goes to only 50% or even 40% being funded, and some say maybe only 25% of the needs in future might be funded also due to climate change, might that also provide some momentum and encouragement to all kind of actors, to organizations who are totally overstretched, to donors, etc., to take these issues of coordination, of getting better, of working better in linkages, to take that more seriously and to accept that they really need to move, even if it might harm institutional interest between ministries or between commissions in Brussels?
Well, what you say, and I would agree with your analysis, makes me think of the good old slogan, never waste a good crisis. We are in a very unhealthy financial situation, obviously. 67% of recorded humanitarian funding comes from the three big donors. And if you add another 4 or 5 donors, you come to up to 90% of the funding. If one of these donors has, catches a cold, then the entire sector, gets a pneumonia or bronchitis or something like that. That's very unhealthy. And chances are that actually in 2025, we are going to feel the lack of finance much, much more violently than we feel it even today. So the question is what to do. And as far as I can see, there are two schools of thought. One, which I would call the conservative school, so to say, basically says, let's withdraw to the essential. We have been growing into sectors over the past 10 years that are not genuinely humanitarian. Let's basically throw that ballast overboard. Let's go back to the kind of approach that we had in the first decade of the century and focus on the very, very hard core of humanitarian needs, because that is what we can still find. I'm not quite sure I would agree with that, because I think it leaves out two other very important thoughts. One is, how can we be more efficient? Which kind of forms of aid would basically reduce the cost, or at least reduce the increase of cost? That's one of the areas why, inter alia, in the Grand Bargain, I'm engaging very much in favor of anticipatory action. If anticipatory action is being implemented in a clever way and works fine, it will basically help us to help earlier, but also at a lesser cost than what we're doing right now, in a situation where we are focusing exclusively, almost exclusively, on response of the crisis. But the other argument is also important. I mean, much has been said, for example, about the impact of climate change on humanitarian needs. I don't see any reason why we should not position, let me use that tactical word, position humanitarian aid as a form, out of many others, but one form of climate adaptation. If nations, for example, in Asia, but also in Africa, are facing more and more climate disasters, from droughts to floods, if a country like Indonesia has at least 150 natural disasters every year in its own country, I don't understand, if that affects hundreds of millions of people and humanitarian aid helps these people in the situation of disaster, why we should not argue about a closer link and speak in favor of a closer link between humanitarian action and climate action. And ultimately, perhaps even see to it that climate money can be used for humanitarian purposes. And I believe that if we, and that is a bit my mantra, if we want to see a globalization of humanitarian action, if we want to see a situation where in 20 years from now, we don't only have money from Germany, the Netherlands, the UK, Canada, the US and Sweden and so forth, but also from Indonesia, also from Malaysia, also from Brazil, and perhaps from the Republic of South Africa. If we want to see that, then basically we need to do a couple of things. We need, for example, to empower their organizations, because we cannot expect those countries to simply finance the Western-based organization that we are used to working with. And secondly, we also need to explain in a revised narrative why humanitarian aid would be good for them. And if a nation in Asia, for example, suffers a lot from climate disasters, why not then tell them, well, in order to be better prepared, build community resilience, help people affected better, use humanitarian aid. So you can always withdraw. You can always follow the conservative line and say, do simply less. We have less money. But before we take such a drastic position, I think we should rather look very critically at the way how we are implementing aid, how we are positioning ourselves, and whether we are really global enough in a policy, in a sector that pretends, and I think rightly so, to be the expression of global values. If humanitarian aid, saving people, easing suffering, is a universal human and global good, then I don't see why we should not open up to other countries, nations, players, and organizations in the world beyond those that we already have in our midst that can contribute to this. But we also then need to listen to them and figure out what is in their interest and how we can develop our way of doing in such a way that they find themselves treated as equal partners at the decision-making table.
indeed a major challenge. And another dimension, if we need to look into a multipolar humanitarian system or even many systems and subsystems in the future with many actors and various motives involved. Michael, final question from my side. Looking back a bit on your era in the sector, and at the same time having in mind that in autumn a new commission is upcoming and will take over and will need to see and prioritize its agenda, etc. Is there anything you think you regret that you couldn't move it faster or that you missed a point where you think, well, that would be a great homework I would like to see my successors picking up?
Well, there are certainly lots of regrets. In hindsight, you're always more intelligent than when you are in the middle of your task, so to say. At the end, you know, as a manager, you always have to find out whether you want to operate change with your people or whether you want to impose it on your people. And sometimes I'm wondering whether I should have been perhaps a little bit more dictatorial here and there. But in reality, what I really believe is that in the European Commission, but also, you know, in other settings where aid decisions are being taken, we need to get serious about fragility. Fragility is not a new word. It's not a new policy discussion, but it has been really neglected over the past years. And we see now that a very significant part of the Global South is increasingly fragile, not necessarily entire countries, sometimes only parts of countries. And our traditional toolbox is not made in order to address that. I feel very strongly about that. And I believe that humanitarians should take the lead in this discussion for two reasons. They know these fragile country situations much better than anybody else. Better than the secret services, better than the military, better than the development people, because they know what's happening with the people in a province or in a state like, for example, in northeast Nigeria. And secondly, and I come back a little bit to your questions and concerns, Ralph, if we do not want to be managed, if we don't want to be changed, if we don't want others to take decisions on what humanitarian aid should do or not do in the future, then it is better if we pose the problem, if we come with solutions, and if we come with approaches that fully honor the principles of humanitarian aid and put people in the center rather than states, governments, foreign policy interests, or perhaps economic interests. So I think we have everything to win by engaging, but we need to be willing to go beyond the frontiers, the confines of the humanitarian sector, and address crisis and fragility in a more comprehensive way. I would hope that my successors, listen to this podcast and are convinced by the argument. And if they're not convinced, it's perfectly fine, but then they should come with better ideas, please.
Thank you so much, Michael. I hope that also they listen to the podcast, of course. And we appreciate that you took time to join us today. It is on a Friday afternoon and you are officially retired, but I know that you have two more meetings to come. So that's impressive. And we are the more grateful that you took time to speak to us and share your views in our new series on humanitarian policies. Thank you so much, Michael, and have a good day.
Thank you, Ralph. My pleasure. I always say I retired from the active service in the European Union, but I did not retire from work and definitely not from humanitarian work. It's a matter of conviction, and I look forward to working with many of those who are listening to this podcast in order to ensure the future of our common sector. All the best.
Same to you. Great final word. Bye-bye.
This is it today from the chat room, the podcast on humanitarian action. You can find all relevant links to this session in the show notes, for example, a link to the mentioned paper in English or German and executive summaries in English, German and French. If you have any feedback or a suggestion as to whom should be interviewed here, we'd love to hear that. Just send us an email to info@charberlin.org. Thanks for listening.